WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the very best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very sorry to say that my scheduled morning show guest for today, Kevin Stewart, director of the Hospitality Center in Racine, was involved in a single vehicle car accident earlier this morning as he was leaving his home in Wauwatosa. I'm relieved to say that Kevin Stewart was not seriously injured in this accident. He's just fine. His car is not. And of course, it was impossible for him to complete the journey down here to Kenosha to be on the morning show today. So I most regret the opportunity that was lost, at least this morning, to have this conversation with Kevin Stewart on a very, very important topic, namely the plight of the homeless in Racine and the good work of the Hospitality Center and what might be ahead. A public forum is being held tomorrow night, and towards the end of the hour, we'll share more information about that. And if logistics allow, I'm inviting Kevin Stewart to join me on tomorrow's morning show instead. But one way or the other, we want to make sure that people know about this important event coming up tomorrow night. So again, no Kevin Stewart on today's morning show. We wish him well. And again, I want to reiterate that he is just fine and is sorry not to be able to join us today on the morning show. In its place, a conversation out of the archives, which I'm not sure we've replayed since it first aired 5 years ago. A conversation with a talented writer by the name of Joshua Lyon, whose book, his memoir, is called Pillhead: The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. Joshua Lyon is a writer who found himself heading down a very, very dark self-destructive path when, while researching an article for Jane Magazine about how easy it was to purchase Vicodin illegally over the internet, ended up making such a purchase himself just to demonstrate how simple it was to do so. And then, in a very fateful move, not only consumed that Vicodin, but then ordered more and very quickly became a full-blown painkiller addict. Joshua Lyon is not alone in this. He is one of an estimated 35 million Americans who are or who have abused painkillers. He writes very frankly and movingly about his addiction and his recovery in this memoir, published by Hatchet Books, again titled Pillhead: The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. I wonder if we could just speak for a moment about what it was like for you to write this book. In some respects, you are unlike some other addicts who have written books in which writing a book was sort of a departure from whatever their lives had been. But before you were an addict, and as you were, and to this day you are a journalist, a writer by trade. And nevertheless, I suspect that this had to represent some kind of strange stepping out to be writing about a story so personal and so difficult. What was it like?
It was tough, I'll be perfectly honest. When I actually wrote the first draft of the book, it didn't end where the book actually ends now. I thought I had gotten myself completely off of painkillers, and I had logged, you know, a really giant chunk of sober time. And I turned the first draft of the book in, and I think what happened is I'd spent so much time writing about the experience of what it felt like to be on these pills. It was my body missed them. I was, you know, regurgitating all these feelings. And I actually relapsed after turning in the first draft of the book. And the last chapter, the last few chapters of the book, are actually very recent in terms of my life. I did end up going to rehab and writing about that rehab experience, but the book doesn't end with, you know, a happily ever after story. You know, I'm just starting to pick the pieces of my life back together. But I think that's a very realistic way to portray an addict story. Addiction is a very chronic and relapsing disease. It's something I'll live with the rest of my life. And I think it's important to let people know that relapse is part of the process of getting sober.
You also mention, actually in the epilogue of the book, there will always be a massive part of my brain that wants opiates. And that's, of course, difficult to hear. I mean, someone who's never been part of this, who has never experienced this in their lives, hopes that something happens, somebody says something or something happens to you, and suddenly these tremendous urges are either taken away or you're talked out of it or medicated away or something. And what you're saying there is this hunger is still with you.
It is. I will say it's not quite as strong as it was when I finished writing the book. I definitely really love and appreciate having a clear brain again. But I mean, even talking about it, you know, even when I'm doing radio interviews like this, you know, when I'm talking, people want to know what they feel like, and I'm going to describe that feeling honestly. They did feel very, very good, and there is still a tinge, like a tinge of nostalgia for it.
Tell our listeners, first of all, briefly, a little bit about your substance abuse before this particular chapter of your life began. Ahead of you first using Vicodin, what kinds of other drugs had you used and how much?
Oh, I definitely used pretty much everything out there. I had used a lot of coke. I used to smoke pot a lot, drank. I don't think I was ever an addict with any of these substances, though. I was a very, I was a big party kid, but I definitely was very, very focused on my career and wouldn't let any of that partying interfere with my career. The difference with painkillers is that I found that I could be high while I was at work, and it wasn't as if I was running into the bathroom at work and doing a line of coke and coming back to my desk and having, you know, stuff leaking out of my nose. Nobody could tell that I was high, and I actually thought that I was doing a pretty good job at my job. And for a while, I'd say the first year of me being on painkillers, there really wasn't a huge noticeable effect at first. It was only over the long term that it really began to eat away at my soul.
Right. One of the most interesting moments in the book for me, as someone who has never tasted any of this, so for me, this is a very, very eye-opening sort of book, and especially your book helps me better understand how someone goes down this path in the first place, which has never been easy for me to understand. You tell a story dating back to maybe when you were 10 years old or so. You say it was not long after you had signed one of those Nancy Reagan cards for Just Say No, and you had just gone to bed. Tell our listeners what you saw outside your bedroom window.
Oh, yes. This was, I was about 10 years old. I have an older sister who's 6 years older than I am, so she was in high school. And I was in bed, had to go to bed early because I was 10, and I heard music like pounding out of a van that pulled up in front of our house, and I went to the window and watched my older sister run to this van. The door opened, she jumped inside, the door slammed, it like drove off into the night, and I was filled with this sense of jealousy and wanting, and just desperately wanted to be out there and part of the night and part of the excitement. And I mean, at this age I was far too young to even really understand what any of that meant. There was just this sense of longing for a longing for experience.
Right. You wrote, the door slammed shut and the van sped off until the street was silent once more. I wanted to be in that van, sitting in the back, surrounded by friends, doing God knows what and driving to nowhere. All I had was the dark bedroom behind me, a silent house, and a gaping and waiting bed that I didn't want to go anywhere near. I wanted an escape, and I swore an oath to myself with such conviction that it has been forever burned into my brain. I will never lead a boring life. What is so striking is that in some respects, that's ultimately where this hunger led you. I mean, for as harrowing a journey as this is, and death-defying in many respects, there is also this aspect, especially once this new addiction to painkillers took you far enough down the road, it ended up, in many respects at least, becoming a very boring life. Or wasn't it in some ways?
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, my idea of all I wanted to do, you know, at the height of my addiction was to just stay home and watch basic cable television. That was all I needed or wanted from the world. It created, painkillers created a bubble around me that I felt was protecting me from scary emotions, from being hurt by anybody. But all it did was shut me down. I pretty much became a zombie.
Let's talk about how you found your way to Vicodin, or how Vicodin first found its way to you. At that point in time, I believe you were writing for Jane magazine. Is that right?
Yeah. I was an associate editor there. And we, this was back in 2003, and we, and I think the rest of America, was starting to get tons of spam email saying, buy Vicodin online, no prescription needed. And I wanted to know if this was just a scam or if this was actually true. You know, I knew that Vicodin was a controlled substance, and I was shocked. I wanted to know if you actually could buy it online without a prescription. So I pitched it as an article, and was given a budget of $600 to see if I could actually get these drugs online. And within 48 hours, I had bottles of Vicodin, Valium, and Xanax waiting for me on my desk. And I wrote the article and said, yes, this is actually something that's happening. You can actually get these online. This is, you know, probably not a very good thing. But it didn't really dive into it much from there. But what happened is my editor told me I was supposed to throw out all the pills. She actually freaked out and called me at home the night after I turned in the article, made me promise that I would throw everything out. I lied and said that I would, and I think it was almost the kind of like panic in her voice that made me want to try it. Not that I'm blaming anybody else except myself for what I did.
Well, and you also say that you've always had this tendency to go against what you are told to do, kind of an anti-authority streak.
Yeah,
and it welled up at this moment, unfortunately for you.
Yeah, and you know, now that I'm older now, and I think I've definitely got that under control a lot more. But yeah, I knew this was something that was forbidden, and for whatever reason, that made me want to do it more. So I swallowed three. I took three Vicodin, and my body's reaction was immediate. And I should say that not everybody's body chemistry will have the same reaction to an opioid. Some people get really nauseous and sick to their stomach, and that actually is one of the things that contributes to, you know, widespread diversion. Is there are people that get prescribed this medication, they don't like the way it makes them feel, they put it away in their medicine cabinet, and that just means there's a full bottle in there for somebody else to take.
Hmm. You called this almost immediately your perfect drug. That is, it was perfect for you. Explain how it was different from other things you had abused before this. I mean, what made this such a perfect drug in your estimation?
Yeah. Well, I'd smoked pot for a long time in high school, but then around college, marijuana just made me feel paranoid, and I think that's something that happens to a lot of people who either first-time users or people who smoke it a while. It's just kind of a well-known common side effect that it can make you really intensely paranoid, and I think I'm a nervous enough person as it is that that's not a good reaction. Cocaine and alcohol, they were fun for me during the moments that I were on them, but the hangovers were just so brutally intense that they weren't things that I could do for very long periods. eased social anxiety. I felt that nothing that anybody said could hurt me. I felt brave. I felt like I could talk to strangers, which is something that I used to have a real problem with. It was a combination of relaxing the social anxiety and just feeling these very warm, physical, pleasurable waves coursing through my body. Of course, what happens is that that feeling doesn't last so long, and you need to start taking more and more of the pills to chase that feeling until you're basically taking a lot of pills and not even getting that pleasurable feeling anymore. You get kind of this baseline high that's not really very satisfying, but it's enough to stave off any of the withdrawal symptoms that you can go through, which are pretty brutal.
Right. And if I remember correctly, the other thing that made this compelling or attractive for you was that you woke up the next morning with nothing like the sort of hangover or kind of wasted feeling that you would so typically have abusing other kinds of substances.
Yeah, I felt great. If anything, there was just a little bit of a residual high. It made me feel just a little cloudy, but nothing. But that cloud actually worked well for me because it, again, was helping with social anxiety. I think it's pretty obvious to me now that I was self-medicating for an existing problem with depression and anxiety. And I was just using the wrong types of medication to help with that.
You happen to be a gay man. Do you suspect that that was a major ingredient in this? Were you someone who had felt sort of like an outsider to others because of your sexual orientation, or do you feel like that really was not a significant factor in, for instance, why you were depressed or why you would seek out such self-destructive behavior?
Yeah, I think for me personally, honestly, being gay has never been an issue. I was really extremely lucky with my experiences coming out. I never really experienced any sort of major homophobia, and that was even like coming out in a very small town, with only 50 people in my graduating class. I personally feel like I was very lucky and never really had any of real major negative problems with that. But that's certainly not to say that that's not the case for other gay people. I mean, I think I've definitely witnessed a huge problem with substance abuse within the gay community. I don't think that's any secret.
Actually, one of the things your book spells out for us is the troubling dimensions of this epidemic of this particular kind of addiction. Describe just what we are talking about in terms of how serious and far-reaching painkiller addiction is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, since I wrote the book, the numbers have just increased in an insane amount. There was actually a new stat that just came out last Thursday from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. Prescription medication abuse, it grew by 400% over the last 10-year period that they studied, and that just blew me away. I mean, 400% is barely even a number that I can comprehend. They're saying it's 48 million people have abused prescription medication. That's almost 20% of the nation's entire population.
Tell us how you were able to facilitate your habit, because that's one of the most interesting things about your story. And I'm not that your story is probably particularly unique in this way, but I mean, for you to continue to get these painkillers in escalating amounts required almost kind of an intricate tap dancing between various sources, various friends, internet sources, and so on. Just describe that to our listeners.
Yeah, you know, the evolution of how I got my pills actually is a really, really clear example of how the problem got so big over the last 10 years. You know, it started with ordering them online from the same websites that I had written about. I didn't actually name the websites in my article, but the same websites where I'd gotten my first pills. I kept ordering refills from them until all of a sudden the website was taken down and it didn't exist anymore. And unbeknownst to me at the time, the DEA was really, really cracking down on these internet pharmacies and were shutting them down left and right. But the problem was that, you know, every time they shut one down, another one would pop up to take its place. All you really had to do was do a Google search for buy Vicodin, and you would find 10 other sites. So the first few years, I relied on the internet, but eventually it got to the point where the DEA was really, really successful at shutting these down, and now it's almost impossible to find these websites online anymore for class, you know, Schedule II substances. I think there's some where you can still buy painkillers. They're just not as strong as the ones that are commonly abused. But once the website started disappearing, all I would do, I would post on Craigslist or post on MySpace and just say, like, hey, anybody have any Vicodin? Anybody got any leftovers? Anyone had surgery recently? And people would write me back and say, yeah, sure, and I would offer to buy it from them. And it just wasn't considered a big deal. It was no big deal. Nobody thought twice about this being something that was actually very illegal. And then I eventually got access to a drug dealer who carried all of these medications, and now that's where a lot of people are getting them. I mean, just normal run-of-the-mill drug dealers carry these medications along with the rest of their wares.
One of the memorable characters with whom you crossed paths was someone who you thought was a myth, someone who'd been called the Candyman.
Yeah.
And you say in many respects, all of this changed dramatically for you, and not for the better, although it felt like it was changing for the better in the moment, of course, when you finally were able to purchase drugs from Candyman for the first time.
Yeah, he was kind of a mythical creature. I'd heard rumors of this person who, a dealer who you could call and would come to your house with a metal briefcase and an actual menu of any kind of pill that you can imagine, and broken down between like opiates, amphetamines, ADHD drugs, benzos, which would be like Valium or Xanax. The dealer was knowledgeable, would tell you what drugs were really dangerous to mix together. If you spent a certain amount of money, you were given a 12-sided Dungeons and Dragons dice that you would roll and call out two numbers. And if one of your two numbers came up, you could reach in and take one free of anything you wanted.
One of the things you say about the whole means of securing these drugs is that, in your view, too much attention or the wrong kind of attention is being given to doctors. And you call it sort of a witch hunt in terms of how law enforcement is going after doctors who prescribe painkillers, maybe in their view, recklessly or carelessly. Explain how you think doctors should and should not be held accountable when it comes to dispensing painkillers that someone might in fact be abusing.
Sure. I think what initially happened is there was a lot of pressure to put an end to this problem early on, and I think the easiest way for officials to track the problem would be to find doctors that they thought were prescribing too much medication. And I want to preface this by saying, like, yes, there are definitely some bad apples out there. There are definitely doctors that align themselves were aligning themselves with the internet pill mills early on in the decade. And there are still, you know, doctors out there that are doing this just to make money. But I think what happens is that an official will look at a doctor's prescribing methods, and they'll see that they're prescribing a patient what they see as giant amounts of a painkiller. And what they're not taking into consideration is that there are so many people out there that need these drugs to survive. There are cancer patients that are, you know, these medications are the only thing that's giving them any kind of sense of peace. And that's why we can't treat this epidemic like any other drug the country has tried to combat before, because they do need to remain available to those people who need them. What happens is people who stay on these medications for a long time, they build up a tolerance, which is a very natural and normal part of the medication process. And yes, they may be taking a high amount of painkillers, but it's because they really legitimately need them because they are in physical pain. And it's honestly jerks like me that is now making it harder for some people who have a real reason to take these pills. It can make it harder for them to get them sometimes because doctors are afraid sometimes to prescribe these medications for fear of getting in trouble.
We're speaking with Joshua Lyon. We are talking about his memoir of painkiller addiction. His book is called Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. One of the things you say about this addiction is, first of all, you're addicted to something that's entirely legal in and of itself. It's not like you are addicted to forbidden substances. So that's, of course, one distinction. Something else you say about this particular kind of addiction is that it is, by its very nature, more of a solitary addiction, that being alone when you are abusing these pills is actually fairly standard, that these are not social drugs. Explain that distinction a little further. That's probably helpful for us in order to better understand the life of this kind of addict.
Yeah, you know, there's two different ways you can take these pills. One is crushing them up and snorting them, which a lot of people do. I never personally got into snorting. For me, it was just swallowing the pills. I liked the extended release feeling that a lot of them gave me by just simply swallowing them and taking them the way they're supposed to be taken. But, you know, if you're going to compare it to something like cocaine, you know, you could be sitting at a dinner table with your folks, and if you were a cocaine addict, you would go to the bathroom to do a couple lines. If you were at a club, you would go to the bathroom with friends. With pills, it's a simple, quick act. You're palming a pill, you're popping it in your mouth, swallowing, and nobody bats an eyelash if you take a pill. I think it's 50% of Americans are on at least one medication for something or another, and a lot of people just let that slide if they see you take a pill. I think the isolating experience also comes from the bubble feeling that pills can give you, that nothing really matters. I just stopped caring about everything. I stopped caring about my friends, my relationships completely disintegrated. I think that's also one of the reasons why it can be really hard to know when somebody is abusing a painkiller. As I said a couple of times before, like, you know, you don't see cocaine leaking out of the nose. You're not constantly sniffling. You're not reeking of marijuana. The signs are very, very, very subtle, and they can be constricted pupils. They can be memory loss. They can be just, you know, being in the middle of a sentence and just kind of like trailing off. A lot of these things you can chalk up to other problems. You know, people are overworked. You could just think that they're distracted if, you know, their memory seems to be sliding a little bit.
I thought another point you make in your book that really helped me understand how someone caught up in this would just be seeing themselves and everybody, you know, in a whole different way, in a way that, you know, ultimately can sort of isolate them and lead to alienation, is when you describe this feeling at one point. This is actually, I think, someone else you spoke to, I think named Jared, who also struggled with painkiller addiction. And you said, he said at one point, I literally could not picture getting through a single day without them, meaning his Percocets. I couldn't understand how the rest of the world was walking around without them.
Yeah.
I'd never stopped to think about that an addict might not only say, I have to have this, I cannot exist without this, but how are the rest of you going on with your lives and functioning and being happy without this thing that I think is essential?
Yeah.
I should think that that's really also a complicating factor in this.
Yeah, you know, I think that speaks highly also to the body chemistry issue that I was talking about, that people who do react really well to these drugs, like Jared and myself, like I can definitely relate to what he's saying there. The feeling, there comes a point when you're taking these drugs every single day for such a long period of time that's what becomes normal to you, and it's almost like being sober is like being messed up on something, because your sense of reality has just become so skewed. You've lived in this like safe, protective bubble for so long that the idea of being outside of it is just terrifying.
Hmm. This when you talk to another addict named Caleb, this is one of the things that he talks about in just contemplating the possibility of leaving behind his addiction to OxyContin. He says, it's hard to say, okay, I'm going to set aside a week when I will feel worse than I've ever felt in my entire life. I'm going to put aside my friends, my family, my job, everything just to check out. It's just so much easier to keep saying, oh, next week, next week.
Yeah.
And of course, for many addicts, next week never comes.
Exactly. And what he's referring to right there is the experience that you go through when you stop taking pills, especially if you stop taking them very suddenly, which I'd like to say right now, if there's anybody listening who is currently abusing painkillers and taking them every day, stopping cold turkey can be very, very dangerous. It's not something you should do. You should really wean yourself slowly off of the medication and definitely with a doctor's help if you can. Withdrawal is a nightmare. You experience nausea, muscle cramping, sweating, upset stomach, fatigue, like flu symptoms. I think the crippling depression is one of the worst parts about it. And the other part for me is that I felt like there was this ice-cold knife scraping my bones. It's not a fun experience.
One of the moments in which, at least temporarily, you were sort of snapped out of this pattern was during a time that you spent caring for your grandmother who lived in Tennessee. Something happened to her, and your father called and essentially sent you there to help take care of her. Tell us what happened to your grandmother to necessitate your visit. And what happened while you were there?
Yeah, my grandmother Bobby. She's a gigantic part of my life. Love her dearly. She had gotten a small cut on her leg, and it became infected, and then the tissue became necrotic, and she ended up having to get pretty major surgery where they basically dug kind of a trench into her leg to get rid of the necrotic tissue and then vacuum sealed it with this medevac machine that kept kind of sucking any of the other dead tissue out of her leg. It was very, very grim and very gory, but she couldn't walk. So my family members, we were taking turns taking care of her. And when it was my turn, I went down there. And because she's such a huge part of my life, I didn't want to be messed up on pills taking care of her. It was kind of being snapped into emergency mode, and thank God at that point in my life, I still had enough humanity left in me that I was able to tell myself, like, no drugs while I'm taking care of my grandmother. I went down there, and of course, because she had just come out of major surgery, she had a giant bottle of Percocet sitting on the bedside table. And I fought with myself incredibly, incredibly hard not to steal those pills from her. I know a lot. I've talked to so many other addicts that have been in similar situations, and they have taken the pills. It's not uncommon at all for this addiction to become so strong that you would literally steal the pills that give your grandmother relief for your own needs. I ended up getting sick. I went through withdrawal for the first few days that I was down there taking care of her. I powered through it. I think tapping tapping into that part of myself that kept myself from stealing her pills was something that really helped me in the future to get off of pills for good. It was knowing that even at that point in my addiction that there was still kind of a moral center that I was able to like tap into. I really held on to that.
A really touching moment in this story, it comes towards the very end of this particular chapter, is one morning when you woke up and your grandmother had had some kind of terrible trouble the night before, and you found her in the bathroom trying to slip her nightgown over her head. Her back and her legs were just covered in her own feces, and she obviously had an accident, and you came in there to help her as best you could. And you write this: it was at this moment that snapped me physically out of my withdrawal. It was the power of seeing someone need me so badly, knowing how she must have felt in that situation, the machine dragging along behind her in the bathroom floor, covered with the mess, that made every physical symptom in my body disappear. Maybe it was the adrenaline rush of knowing I needed to go into emergency mode and make her feel safe at the same time. And in a sense, that's when we realize that this is the opposite of that protective bubble you were describing earlier, which is what these drugs would give you.
Yes, I was shot right out of it. And I do think there was, I mean, the human body is a pretty powerful thing. I do think the adrenaline is what helps me cut through the actual physical symptoms of being sick in that situation. Mm. But yeah, as I said before, it was a good reminder that I was human and that I lived around other humans and that people need each other, and that's really the way life is supposed to be lived. Mm.
Through much of this book, you are talking to other addicts. We've already mentioned some of them that you got to know and spoke with and so on. And the impression I get, this is just one of the only things I'm confused about in the book, is that it appears that you were doing so professionally or semi-professionally. I mean, speaking to other addicts about their addiction. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. Every addict that I spoke to, I had mentioned earlier that I relapsed at the end of the book. During the period that I was writing the majority of the book, I was sober, and I was speaking to these addicts as a journalist, but also I think the reason why people were willing to be so open with me about their stories is that I was very open about my own experience, and I could really relate to everything that they were saying. So a lot of the interviews that happened were done in very, conversational ways, as opposed
right.
to just like strict, question and answer.
And they were aware of your own background and
your
own demons.
Definitely.
You paint an honest picture of the rocky road back to sobriety for you. And as you describe that, we get a sense that you have some grave misgivings about the way in which this particular addiction tends to be dealt with. What is being done wrong in trying to help painkiller addicts out of this particular kind of addiction?
That's a good question, but I think the answer also speaks to addiction across the board, which is that I've met very, very, very few people who have gone into a 30-day rehab program and come out and been able to stay sober the rest of their life. And that is not to say that this is something that people shouldn't do. I think they definitely should, but I think the whole idea of a 30-day rehab, 30 days is a number that was created by insurance companies so that there'd be an insurance cap. It has nothing to do with, spending 30 days sober is going to actually cure you. I think that what needs to be happening is more money and research needs to go into the study of addiction itself, into the nature of addiction. I don't think we're really going to be able to fix any of this until we know more about what addiction is and how it works within the body. Speaking specifically for painkillers, when I went into rehab, I was given a drug called Suboxone to help with my withdrawal symptoms. And I like to say that Suboxone is the new methadone. It's a little more complicated than that. Suboxone is a partial analgesic, so it is an opiate. You are getting a dose of an opiate, but it is mixed with a drug called naloxone, which is a drug that knocks opiates off of the receptors in your brain, so you can't really get high. So if you try and crush or snort Suboxone, you will not get high. In fact, you'll probably go into withdrawal. But because it is a partial analgesic, there is an opiate in there, so you do get high to a certain extent. It's just that you don't really pass a certain point. And what happened for me is that I realized that I could actually abuse the Suboxone they were giving me in rehab. I was, as soon as I realized that Suboxone made me partially high, I started palming it and saving it instead of taking it on a regular daily basis so that I would have evened out to a certain point, and used that to get high. And I eventually got off of all of that. I'm actually working on a book right now specifically about Suboxone, because about a year ago I was getting nervous that I might have a relapse, so I went back on Suboxone in the way that you're supposed to take it as part of a daily program. What happened for me personally is that it ended up, I feel like I got addicted to the cure in a way. Suboxone became just as much of a crutch for me as any of the pills that I'd been on earlier had been. So I'm right now focusing a lot and trying to do some more research about this medication.
Fascinating. For you, has ultimately writing this book, retelling this, reliving this, been helpful for you in your quest to come to terms with this and ultimately remain sober?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest and most important and helpful part has been meeting and talking with so many other people that have gone through the exact same thing. Like, literally, I think every single person I've ever talked to about this subject has either had some kind of experience with painkillers themselves, or they know somebody. I have a close friend or family member who has had a bad experience with painkillers. It's so widespread, and it's unfortunately, I think, part of the human experience that people get addicted.
The book is Pillhead, The Secret Life of a Painkiller Addict. The book is now available in paperback from Hyperion. The author, Joshua Lyon. Joshua Lyon, I appreciate you joining me today. I appreciate you writing such an important book, and I do wish you well in all that is ahead for you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
We want to remind you that, first of all, today's previously scheduled guest, Kevin Stewart, was going to be joining us today to talk about the very important topic of homelessness and the various outreach efforts of the Hospitality Center. He was unable to join us, actually, at the last minute, but I do want to make sure that I announce the special public forum, which we were going to be talking about, among other things, on today's program. That public forum is going to be held tomorrow evening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College, 1001 South Main Street, in the Racine building. The public forum is sponsored by the Continuum of Care, the umbrella coalition over most of the major shelters and nearly 90 nonprofits in Racine, who minister to the homeless. Let's look ahead to some of the morning shows which are coming up over the next several days. Tomorrow, unless we're able to reschedule Kevin Stewart's appearance on the morning show, tomorrow will be Dr. Vera Tarman actually talking about another kind of addiction, so a topic related to what we were hearing on today's morning show. Dr. Vera Tarman works with people who suffer from various kinds of addictions, but has devoted much of her time and energy in recent years to those whom she believes are suffering from food addictions. And she has come to believe that certain people are addicted to certain kinds of food every bit as potently as others who are addicted to narcotics or alcohol or addicted to other activities. She has written a new book about it called Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addiction. It's quite a fascinating book, and you'll hear our conversation tomorrow. Wednesday, I'm going to be speaking with a former Navy SEAL by the name of Eric Grittens, who has written a book called Resilience, A Hard-Won Wisdom for Living a Better Life. Eric Grittens has done remarkable work, particularly in reaching out to American veterans and also working with many of them to try to rebuild new experiences and new meaningful lives once they have returned home from deployment. This new book not only recounts some of those efforts, but explores the very nature of resiliency, something which we tend to misunderstand. Resilience does not mean bouncing back in your and returning to your former state. Resiliency often means achieving a new state of healthiness and wholeness in the wake of something which has been of devastating damage. It's a very, very well-written book, and you'll hear my conversation on Wednesday. Thursday, several interviews, including one with composer Jennifer Higdon. Her work called Blue Cathedral is going to be performed this coming weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. It's one of the most often performed modern orchestral works, and we will talk with her about her career and about this beautiful little masterpiece. On Friday, we discard our typical morning show format and make way for a special edition of Education Matters so that you can hear from some of the candidates for the Racine Unified School Board. That election is coming up in early April, and Dwayne Olson will be hosting a candidates forum this Friday. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that the program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the very best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. We expect 1 to 2 inches of snow for most of Racine and Kenosha counties this morning, possibly up to 4 inches in some parts of Walworth County, a high of 33 degrees. Overnight low of 22, tomorrow we warm to 43. This is WGTDHD